In this manner was I prevented from continuing my travels to the kingdom of the Yiltuar, king of the Sakaliba, and thus was I unable to discharge the trust of Al-Muqtadir, commander of the faithful and caliph of the City of Peace. I gave such instructions as I could to Dadir al-Harami, also to the ambassador Abdallah ibn Batsu al-Hazari, and also the pages Takin and Bars. Then I took my leave of them, and how they fared further I never knew. For myself, I counted my condition no different from a dead man. I was on board one of the Northmen vessels, and sailing up the Volga River northward with 12 of their company. The others were named thus: Bulliwith, the chief, his lieutenant or captain Ekthgau, his earls and nobles Higlak, Skeld, Wiaf, Ronaf, Halga, his warriors and brave fighters Helfdane, Edgo, Rethel, Haltef, and Herger.
Wulfgar was left behind. Jensen says that the Northmen commonly held a messenger as hostage, and this was why appropriate messengers were the sons of kings or high nobles or other persons who had some value to their own community, which made them fitting hostages. Olaf Jorgensen says that Wulfgar remained behind because he was afraid to go back.
And also I was among them, unable to speak their language or to understand their ways, for my interpreter had been left behind. It was only happenstance and the grace of Allah that one of their warriors, Herger, should be a man of parts and knowing some of the Latin tongue. Thus could I understand from Herger what meant the events that transpired. Herger was a young warrior and very merry. He seemed to find jest in everything, and especially in my own gloom at the departure. These Northmen are by their own accounting the best sailors in the world, and I saw much love of the oceans and waters in their demeanor. Of the ship there is this: it was as long as 25 paces, and as broad as 8, and little more than that, and of excellent construction of oak wood. Its color was black. It was fitted with a square sail of cloth and trimmed with sealskin ropes. The helmsman stood upon a small platform near the stern and worked a rudder attached to the side of the vessel. The ship was fitted with benches for oars, but never were the oars employed. Rather, we progressed by sailing alone. At the head of the ship was the wooden carving of a fierce sea monster, such as appears on some Northmen vessels. Also, there was a tail at the stern. In water, this ship was stable and quite pleasant for travelling, and the confidence of the warriors elevated my spirits. Near the helmsman was a bed of skins arranged upon a network of ropes, with a skin covering. This was the bed of Bulliwith. The other warriors slept upon the deck, wrapping skins about them, and I did as much also. We travelled upon the river for 3 days, passing many small settlements at the edge of the water. Then we came upon a large encampment in a bend in the river Volga. Here were many hundreds of people, and a town of good size, and in the center of the town a kremlin, or fortress, with earthen walls, and all of impressive dimensions. Herger said to me, "This is the city of Bulgar, of the kingdom of the Sakaliba. That is the kremlin of the Yiltuar, king of the Sakaliba." I replied, "This is the very king I was sent to see as emissary from my caliph, and with many entreaties I requested to be put upon that shore. Also I demanded and made a show of anger to the extent that I dared." Verily, the Northman paid me no heed. Herger laughed into my face and turned his attention to the sailing of the ship. Thus the Northman's vessels sailed past the city of Bulgar, so close upon the shore that I heard the shouts of merchants and the bleating of sheep, and yet I was helpless and could do nothing save witness the sight with my eyes. After the passing of an hour, even this was refused me. For the Bulgar city is at the bend of the river, as I have said, and soon absent from my view. Thus did I enter and leave Bulgaria.
The listener may now be hopelessly confused about geography. Modern Bulgaria is one of the Balkan states. It's bordered by Greece, Yugoslavia, Romania, and Turkey. But from the 9th to the 15th centuries, there was another Bulgaria, on the banks of the Volga, roughly 600 miles east of modern Moscow, and this is where Ibn Fadlan was heading.
Then passed 8 more days traveling the Volga River, and the land was more mountainous about the valley of the river. Now we came to another branching of the river, where it is called by the Northmen the Oker, and we continued on for 10 days farther. The air was chill, and the wind strong, and much snow lay still upon the ground. They have many great forests also in this region, which the Northmen call Vada. Then we came to a camp of North people, which was Masborg. This town lives by the sale of foodstuff to traders who come back and forth along this route. At Masborg we left our vessel and travelled overland by horse for 18 days. This was a difficult mountain region and exceedingly cold, and I was much exhausted by the rigours of the journey. These North people never travel at night. Yet this was the occurrence. During our travels, the period of the night became so short you could not cook a pot of meat in the time of it. Verily, it seemed that as soon as I lay down to sleep, I was awakened by the Northman, who said, "Come, it is day, we must continue the journey." Nor was the sleep refreshing in these cold places. Also, Hugger explained to me that in this North country the day is long in the summer, and the night is long in the winter, and rarely are they equal. Then he said to me I should watch in the night for the sky curtain, and upon one evening I did, and I saw in the sky shimmering pale lights of green and yellow, and sometimes blue, which hung as a curtain in the high air. I was much amazed by the sight of this sky curtain, but the Northmen counted nothing strange. Now we travelled for 5 days down from the mountains into a region of forests. The forests of the Northlands are cold and dense with gigantic trees. It is a wet and chilling land, in some locations so green that the eyes ache from the brightness of the colour, yet in other locations it is black and dark and menacing. Now we travelled 7 days farther through the forests, and we experienced much rain. These Northmen feared no robbers in the forests, and whether from their own great strength or the lack of any bandits, in truth, we met no one in the forests. The North country has few people of any sort, or so it appeared during my sojourn there. We often travelled 7 days, or 10, without viewing any settlement, or farm, or dwelling. It rained many days. Many times at night it rained, and we sought shelter beneath large trees. Yet we arose drenched, and our sleeping skins drenched likewise. The Northmen did not grumble at this, for they are cheerful at all times. I alone grumbled, and mightily. They paid me no attention. Finally I said to Hugger, "The rain is cold." To this he laughed. "How can the rain be cold? You are cold, and you are unhappy. The rain is not cold or unhappy." I saw that he believed this foolishness, and truly thought me foolish to think otherwise, and yet I did. Now it happened that one night while we ate, I said over my food, "In the name of God," and Bulliwiff inquired of Hugger what it was I said. I told to Hugger that I believed food must be consecrated, and so I did this according to my beliefs. Bulliwiff said to me, "This is the way of the Arabs?" Hugger was the translator. I made this reply, "No, for in truth he who kills the food must make the consecration. I speak the words so as not to be forgetful."
This is a typically Muslim sentiment. Sin for a Muslim is forgetfulness in carrying out the prescribed daily rituals of the religion. As a corollary, it is a more serious offense to forget the ritual entirely than to remember the ritual and yet fail to carry it out, either through extenuating circumstances or personal inadequacy. Thus, Ibn Fadlan is saying, in effect, that he is mindful of proper conduct even though he is not acting according to it. This is better than nothing.
This the Northmen found a reason for humor. They laughed heartily. Then Bulliwiff said to me, "Can you draw sounds?" I understood he meant writing. I replied to Bulliwiff that I could write and also read. He said that I should write for him upon the ground. In the light of the evening fire, I took a stick and wrote, "Praise be to God." All the Northmen looked at the writing. I was commanded to speak what it said, and this I did. Now Bulliwiff stared at the writing for a long period, his head sunk upon his chest. Hergr said to me, "Which god do you praise?" I answered that I praised the one god whose name was Allah. Hergr said, "One god cannot be enough." Now we travelled another day, and on the next evening, Bulliwif took a stick and drew in the earth what I had formerly drawn, and commanded me to read. I spoke aloud the words, "Praise be to God." At this, Bulliwif was satisfied, and I saw that he had contrived a test of me, placing in his memory the symbols I had drawn to show them to me again. Now, Ekthgo, the lieutenant or captain of Bulliwif, and a warrior less merry than the others, a stern man, spoke to me through Hergr. "Ekthgar wishes to know if you can draw the sound of his name." I said that I could, and I took up the stick and began to draw in the dirt. At once Ekthgo leapt up, flung away the stick, and stamped out my writing. He spoke angry words. Hergr said to me, "Ekthgar does not wish you to draw his name at any time, and this you must promise." Here I was perplexed, and I saw that Ekthgar was angry with me in the extreme. So also were the others staring at me with concern and anger. I promised to Hergr that I would not draw the name of Ekthgar or of any of the others. At this they were all relieved. After this, no more was my writing discussed. But Bulliwif gave certain instructions, and whenever it rained, I was always directed to the largest tree, and I was given more food than before. Not always did we sleep in the forests, nor did we always ride through the forests. At the border of some forests, Bulliwif and his warriors would plunge forward, riding at a gallop through the dense trees without a care or a thought of fear. And then again, at other forests, he would draw up and pause, and the warriors would dismount and burn a fire and make some offering of food or a few sheets of hard bread before continuing further. And then they would ride around the edge of the forest. I inquired of Hergr why this should be. He said that some forests were safe and some were not, but did not explain further. I asked him, "What is not safe in the forests that are judged so?" He made this reply, "There are things no man can conquer, and no sword can kill, and no fire can burn, and such things are in the forests." "How is this known to be?" At this he laughed and said, "You Arabs always wish to have reasons for everything. Your hearts are a great bursting bag of reasons." I said, "And you do not care for reason?" "It avails you nothing. We say a man should be moderately wise, but not overwise, lest he know his fate in advance. The man whose mind is most free of care does not know his fate in advance." Now I saw that I must be content with his answer, for it was true that upon one occasion or another I would make some manner of inquiry, and Hergr would reply, and if I did not comprehend his answer, I would ask further, and he would reply further. Yet again, when I made of him an inquiry, he would reply in short fashion, as if the inquiry were of no substance, and then I would have nothing further from him, save a shaking of his head. Now we continue on. Verily, I can say that some of the forests in the wild north country do provoke a feeling of fear, for which I cannot account. At night, sitting about the fire, the northmen told stories of dragons and fierce beasts, and also of their ancestors who had slain these creatures. These, they said, were the source of my fear. But they told the stories with no show of fear, and of such beasts I saw nothing with my own eyes. One night I heard a grumbling that I took to be thunder, but they said it was the growl of a dragon in the forest. I do not know what is the truth, and report now only what was said to me. The people of this region are pale as linen, and their hair is very fair. After so many days of travel, I saw no dark people at all, and indeed I was marveled at by the inhabitants of that region on account of my skin and dark hair. Many times a farmer or his wife or daughter would come forth to touch me with a stroking motion. Hergr laughed and said they were trying to brush away the color, thinking it to be painted upon my flesh. They are ignorant people with no knowledge of the wideness of the world. Many times they feared me and would not approach me close. At one place, a child cried out in terror and ran to cling to his mother when he saw me. At this, the warriors of Buliwif laughed with great merriment. But now I observed this thing. With the passing of the days, the warriors of Buliwif ceased to laugh and fell into an ill humor more each day. Herga said to me they were thinking of drink, of which we had been deprived for many days. At each farm or dwelling, Buliwif and his warriors asked for drink, but in these poor places there was often no liquor. At length we arrived at a village, and there the warriors found drink, and all of the Northmen became intoxicated in a moment, drinking in raucous fashion, heedless that the liquor poured over their chins and clothing in their haste. In truth, one of the company, the solemn warrior Ethgau, was so demented from liquor that he was drunk, while still upon his horse, and fell while attempting to dismount. Now the horse kicked him in the head, and I feared for his safety, but Ethgau laughed and kicked the horse back. We remained in the village for the space of 2 days. I was much amazed, for previously the warriors had shown great haste and purpose in their journey. Yet all was now abandoned to drink and stuporous slumber. Then upon the 3rd day, Buliwif directed that we should continue, and the warriors proceeded, I among them, and they accounted the loss of 2 days nothing strange. How many days further we travelled, I am not certain. I know that 5 times we changed horses for fresh mounts, paying for these in the villages with gold and with the little green shells that the Northmen value more highly than any other objects in the world. And at length we came to a village of the name Lenneborg, situated by the sea. Here we took another vessel. I was afraid to go upon this sea, for the water was rough and very cold. A man's hand plunged into that sea would lack all feeling in an instant. And yet the Northmen were cheerful, and joked and drank for an evening in this sea village of Lenneborg, and disported themselves with many of the women and slave girls. This, I was told, is the Northman's custom before a sea voyage, for no man knows if he shall survive the journey, and thus he departs with excessive revelry. In every place we were greeted with great hospitality, for that is considered a virtue by these people. The poorest farmer would set all he had before us, and this without fear that we would kill or rob him, but only out of goodness and grace. The Northmen, I learned, do not countenance robbers or killers of their own race, and treat such men harshly. These beliefs they hold despite the truth of the matter, which is that they are always drunk and brawling like unreasoning animals, and killing each other in hot duels. Yet they do not see this as murder, and any man who murders will be himself killed. Further, I saw that in each place where we rested, the people inquired of Buliwif what quest he had undertaken, and when they were informed of its nature, that which I did not yet comprehend, he and his warriors, and I among them, were accorded the highest respect, receiving their prayers and sacrifices and tokens of good wishes. At sea, as I have said, the Northmen become happy and jubilant, although the ocean was rough and forbidding to my way of thinking, and also to my stomach, which felt most delicate and unsettled. Indeed, I purged myself, and then asked Herger why his companions were so happy.
It is because we shall soon be at the home of Buliwif, the place known as Yatlam, where live his father and his mother and all his relatives, and he has not seen them for many long years.
To this I said, are we not going to Wulfgar's land?
Yes, but it is fitting that Buliwif must pay homage to his father and also his mother.
I saw by their faces that all the other earls, nobles, and warriors were happy as Buliwif himself. I asked Herger why this was so.
Buliwif is our chief, and we are happy for him, and for the power that he will soon have.
I inquired what was this power of which he spoke.
The power of Runding, the power of the ancients, the power of the giants.
The Northmen believe that in ages past the world was populated by a race of giant men who have since vanished. The Northmen do not count themselves the descendants of these giants, but they have received some of the powers of these ancient giants in such ways as I do not understand well. These heathens also believe in many gods, who are themselves giants and who also have power. But the giants of which Hergr spoke were giant men and not gods, or so it seemed to me. That night we beached upon a rocky shore, and there Bulliwif encamped with his men, and long into the night they drank and sang around the fire. Hergr joined in the celebration, and had no patience to explain to me the meanings of the songs, and so I do not know what they sang, but they were happy. On the morrow they would come to the home of Bulliwif, the land called Jatlam. We left before the first light of dawn. There was a point of land, a high rocky outcrop of grey stone above the grey sea, and beyond this point, Hergr told me, would be the town of Jatlam. I strained to see this fabled home of Bulliwif as the Northman's vessel came around the cliff. The warriors laughed and cheered more loudly. And then there was the smell of smoke on the sea, and we saw smoke, and all the men fell silent. As we came around the point, I saw with my own eyes that the town there was in smoldering flames and billowing black smoke. There was no sign of life. Bulliwif and his warriors landed and walked the town of Jatlam. There were dead bodies of men and women and children, some hacked by swords, a multitude of corpses. Bulliwif and the warriors did not speak, and yet even here there was no grief, no crying and sadness. Never have I seen a race that accepts death as the Northmen do. I myself was sick many times at the sights, and they were never so. At last I said to Hergr, "Who has done this?" Hergr pointed into the land. There were mists over the forests. He pointed and did not speak. I said to him, "Is it the mists?" He said to me, "Do not ask more. You will know sooner than you wish." Now this happened. Bulliwif entered one smoking ruined house and returned to our company bearing a sword. This sword was very large and heavy, and so heated by the fire that he carried it with a cloth wrapped around the handle. Verily, I say, it was the largest sword I have ever seen. It was as long as my own body, and the blade was flat and broad as the palms of two men's hands. It was so large and heavy that even Bulliwif grunted at the carrying of it. I asked Hergr what was the sword, and he said, "That is Runding." And then Bulliwif ordered all his party to the boat, and we set out to sea again. None of the warriors looked back at the burning town of Jatlam. I alone did this, and I saw the smoking ruin and the mists in the hills beyond. For the space of 2 days, we sailed along a flat coast among many islands that are called the Land of Dans, coming finally to a region of marsh with a criss-cross of narrow rivers that pour onto the sea. These rivers have no names themselves, but are each one called Wyke, and the people of the narrow rivers are called Wykings, which means the Northmen warriors who sail their ships up the rivers and attack settlements in such fashion.
There's some dispute among modern scholars about the origin of the term Viking, but most agree with Ibn Fadlan that it derives from Vike, meaning a creek or a narrow river.
Now in this marshy region we stopped at a place called Trelberg, which was a wonder to me. Here is no town, but rather a military camp, and its people are warriors with few women or children among them. Trelberg lies at the joining point of two Wykes. These then run to the sea. The main part of the town is encircled by a round earthwork wall, as tall as 5 men. Above this earthen ring there stands a wooden fence for greater protection. Outside the earthen ring there is a ditch filled with water, the depth I do not know. And there is this further, on the landward side of the town, a second semicircle of high wall, and a second ditch beyond. The town itself lies within the inner ring. Inside the town stand 16 wooden dwellings, all the same. They are longhouses, for so the Northmen call them. In length they are 30 paces. They are arranged thus. 4 long houses precisely set so as to form a square. 4 squares are arranged to make 16 houses in all. Every long house has but one entrance, and no house has its entrance within sight of another. I inquired why this was so, and Herger said thus,
"If the camp is attacked, the men must run to defense, and the doorways are such that the men can hasten without mingling and confusion."
Then also I saw that while the Northmen are gigantic, these doorways were so low that even I must bend in two to enter one of the houses. I inquired of Herger, who said,
"If we are attacked, a single warrior may remain inside the house and with his sword cut off the heads of all who enter. The door is low, so that heads will be bent for cutting."
Verily, I saw that in all respects the Trelberg town was constructed for warfare and for defense. No trading is conducted here at all. Now I saw that the Trelberg people were not as the Northmen along the Volga. These were clean people for their race. They washed in the river, and relieved their waste out of doors, and were in all ways much superior to what I had known. Yet they are not truly clean, except in comparison. Bulliwif and his company were graciously received by the chiefs of Trelberg, who are several, foremost among them one who is called Sagard. Sagard is a strong and fierce man, almost as huge as Bulliwif himself. During the night banquet, Sagard inquired of Bulliwif his mission, and Bulliwif reported the supplication of Wolfgar. Herger translated all for me, although in truth I had spent sufficient time among these heathens to learn a word or two in their tongue. Here is the meaning of the conversation of Sagard and Bulliwif. Sagard spoke thus,
"It is sensible for Wolfgar to carry out the errand of a messenger, though he is the son of the king Hrothgar, for the several sons of Hrothgar have set upon one another."
Bulliwif said that he did not know of this, or words to that meaning, but I perceived that he was not greatly surprised. Yet it is true that Bulliwif was seldom surprised by anything. Such was his role as leader of the warriors and hero to them. Sagard spoke again.
"Indeed, Hrothgar had 5 sons, and 3 are dead at the hand of one of them, Wiglif, a cunning man, whose conspirator in this affair is the herald of the old king. Only Wolfgar remains faithful, and he has departed."
Bulliwif said to Sagard that he was glad to know of this news, and would hold it in his mind, and there the conversation ended. Never did Bulliwif or any of his warriors show surprise at the words of Sagard, and from this I took that it is ordinary for the sons of a king to dispose of one another to gain the throne. Upon our departure, I inquired of Herger why there should be another fortification on the landward side of Trelberg, and yet no such additional fortification on the seaward side. "These Northmen are seafaring men who attack from the sea," and yet Herger said,
"It is the land that is dangerous because of the mists."
Upon our departure from Trelberg, the warriors assembled there beat their staves upon their shields, raising a loud noise for our ship, which set sail. This, I was told, was to draw the attention of Odin, one of the number of their gods, so that this Odin would look with favor upon the journey of Bulliwif and his 12 men. Also this I learned, that the number 13 is significant to the Norsemen, because the moon grows and dies 13 times in the passage of 1 year by their reckoning. For this reason, all important accountings must include the number 13. Thus Herger said to me that the number of dwellings in Trelberg was 13, and also 3 more, instead of 16, as I had expressed it. Further, I learned that these Northmen have some notion that the year does not fit with exactitude into 13 passages of the moon, and thus the number 13 is not stable and fixed in their minds. The 13th passage is called magical and foreign, and Herger says,
"Thus, for the 13th man, you were chosen as foreign."
Verily, these Northmen are superstitious, with no recourse to sense or reason or law. They seemed to my eyes to be fierce children, and yet I was among them, and so held my tongue. Soon enough, I was glad for my discretion, for these events followed. We were sailing some time from Trelberg when I recalled that never previously had the inhabitants of a town made a departure ceremony with beating of shields to call up Odin. I spoke as much to Herger.
"It is true," he responded. "There is a special reason for the call to Odin, for we are now upon the Sea of Monsters."
This seemed to me proof of their superstition. I inquired if any of the warriors had ever seen such monsters.
"Indeed, we have all seen them. Why else should we know of them?"
By the tone of his voice, I could recognize that he thought me a fool for my disbelief. Some further time passed, when there was a shout, and all the warriors of Bulliwif stood pointing to the sea, watching, shouting amongst themselves. I asked Herger what had happened.
"We are among the monsters now," he said, pointing.
Then one of their number shouted to Odin, a scream of prayer, repeating the name many times, and then I also saw with my own eyes the sea monster. It was in the shape of a giant snake that never raised its head above the surface, yet I saw its body curl and twist over, and it was very long and wider than the Northman's boat and black in color. The sea monster spat water into the air like a fountain, and then plunged down, raising a tail that was cleft in two, like the forked tongue of a snake. Now I saw another monster, and another after that. There appeared to be four, and perhaps six or seven. At the sight, the Northmen shouted to Odin for aid, and not a few of their number fell to their knees on the deck, trembling. Verily I saw with my own eyes the sea monsters all about us in the ocean, and then, after some time had passed, they were gone, and we did not see them again. In the evening, we beached and made a fire, and I inquired of Herger if the sea monsters ever attacked a ship on the sea. Herger answered by calling Ekthgau. Herger said that he had been on a ship that was attacked. Ekthgau said this to me, that the sea monsters are larger than anything on the surface of the land, and larger than any ship on the sea. And when they attack, they ride under a ship and lift it in the air and toss it aside like a bit of wood and crush it with their forked tongue. Ekthgau said that there had been 30 men on his ship, and only he and two others beside had survived. Ekthgau spoke in an ordinary manner of talking, which for him was very serious, and I believed him to be speaking the truth. Also, Ekthgau told me that the Northmen know that the monsters attack ships because they desire to mate with the ship, mistaking it for one of their own. For this reason, the Northmen do not build their ships over large. Herger said to me that Ekthgau is a great warrior, renowned in battle, and that he is to be believed in all things.
This account of what is obviously a sighting of whales is disputed by many scholars. The Northmen knew about whales, and they distinguished them from sea monsters. Other scholars doubt that Ibn Fadlan could be unaware of the existence of whales, as he appears to be here.
For the next 2 days, we sailed among the islands of the Dan country, and then on the third day, we crossed a passage of open water, and eventually arrived at the territory called Venden. These lands of Venden are mountainous and forbidding, and the men of Bulliwif in his boat approached with some trepidation and the killing of a hen, which was thrown into the ocean thus. The head was thrown from the bow of the ship, and the body of the hen was thrown from the stern near the helmsman. We did not beach directly on this new land of Venden, but sailed along the coast, coming at last to the kingdom of Hrothgar. I first saw it thus. High upon a cliff, commanding a view of the sea, was a huge great hall of wood, strong and imposing. I said to Herger it was a magnificent sight, but Herger and all his company, led by Bulliwif, were groaning and shaking their heads. I inquired of Herger why this was so. He said,
"Hrothgar is called Hrothgar the Vain, and his great hall is the mark of a vain man."
Why do you speak thus? Because of its size and splendor? For verily, as we came closer, I saw that the hall was richly ornamented with carvings and silver chasing, which sparkled from a distance.
No, said Hergr. I say that Hrothgar is vain because of the way he has placed his settlement. He dares the gods to strike him down, and he pretends he is more than a man, and so he is punished.
Never had I seen a more impregnable great hall, and I said to Hergr, This hall cannot be attacked. How can Hrothgar be struck down? Hergr laughed at me, and said thus,
You Arabs are stupid beyond counting, and know nothing of the ways of the world. Hrothgar deserves the misfortune that has come to him, and it is only we who shall save him, and perhaps not even so.
These words puzzled me further. I looked at Ecgtheow, the lieutenant of Bulliwith, and saw that he stood in the boat and made a brave face. And yet his knees trembled, and it was not the stiffness of the wind that made them tremble so. He was afraid. They were all afraid. And I did not know why. Each warrior in the boat dressed in the garments of battle, which were thus. First, boots and legging of rough wool, and over this, a coat of heavy fur, which reached to the knees. Over this, they placed coats of mail, which all had, save me. Then each man took his sword and clasped it to his belt. Each man took up his white shield of hide and his spear. Each man placed a helmet of metal or leather upon his head. In this, all the men were the same, except for Bulliwith, who alone carried his sword in his hand, so large was it. The warriors looked up to the great hall of Hrothgar, and agreed that there was none like it in the world, with its lofty gables and rich carving. Yet there was no respect in their speech. At length we decamped from the ship, and travelled a road paved in stone up to the great hall. The clanking of swords and the clatter of mail raised a goodly noise. After we had gone some short distance, we saw by the roadway the severed head of an ox set upon a stick. The animal was freshly killed. All the Northmen sighed and made sad faces at this portent, though it had no meaning to me. I was by now adjusted to their custom of killing some beast at the slightest nervousness or provocation, yet this ox head had especial significance. Bulliwith looked away across the fields of the lands of Hrothgar, and saw there an isolated farming house of the sort that is common in Hrothgar lands. The walls of this house were of wood. The roof is thatched material and wood also. Inside there is only an earthen floor and a hearth, and the dung of animals, for the farm people sleep with their animals indoors for the warmth afforded by their bodies, and then they burn the dung for fires. Bulliwith gave an order that we should go to this farmhouse, and so we set out across the fields. Once or twice, Bulliwith halted his company and pointed to the dark earth. Verily, I saw with my own eyes the bare imprint of a foot, indeed of many feet. They were flat and uglier than anything known to creation. At each toe there was the sharp digging mark of a horned nail or claw. Thus the shape appeared human, but yet not human. This I saw with my own eyes, and could scarcely believe the witness of my sight. Bulliwith and his warriors shook their heads at the sight, and I heard them repeat one word over and over, Wendel or Wendlen, or some such. The meaning of the name was not known to me, and I sensed that Hergr should not be asked at this moment, for he was as apprehensive as all the rest. We pressed on to the farmhouse, now and again seeing more of these horned footprints in the earth. Bulliwith and his warriors walked slowly, but it was not caution. No man drew his weapon. Rather, it was some dread that I did not comprehend, and yet felt with them. At length we came to the farming dwelling and entered it. In the farmhouse I saw with my own eyes this sight. There was a man of young age whose body had been torn limb from limb. The torso was here, an arm there, a leg there. Blood lay in thick pools upon the floor, and on the walls, on the roof, on every surface, in such profusion that the house seemed to have been painted in red blood. Also there was a woman, in like fashion, rendered limb from limb. Also a male child, an infant of 2 years or less. All this I saw with my own eyes, and it was the most fearsome sight I ever witnessed. I purged myself and was faint for an hour, purging myself yet again. Never will I comprehend the manner of the Northmen, for even as I was sick, so they became calm and dispassionate at the aspect of this horror. They viewed all they saw in quiet fashion. They discussed the claw marks upon the limbs and the manner of tearing of flesh. Much attention was given to the fact that all the heads were missing. Also, they remarked the most devilish aspect of all, which even now I recall with trepidation. The body of the male child had been chewed by some fiendish teeth. This very horror I saw with my own eyes. The warriors of Bullywiff were grim-countenanced and glowering as they departed the farmhouse. They continued to pay much heed to the soft earth about the house, noting that there were no hoof marks of horses. This was a matter of significance to them. I did not understand why, nor was I much attentive, still feeling faint of heart and sick of body. As we crossed the fields, Ecgtheow made a discovery which was of this nature. It was a small bit of stone, smaller than a child's fist, and it was polished and carved in crude fashion. All the warriors crowded around to examine it, I among them. I saw it to be the torso of a pregnant female. There was no head, no arms and no legs, only the torso with the great swollen belly, and above that, two pendulous swollen breasts. I accounted this creation exceedingly rude and ugly, but nothing more. Yet the Northmen were suddenly overcome and pale and tremulous. Their hands shook to touch it, and finally Bullywiff flung it to the ground and shattered it with the handle of his sword until it lay in splintered stone fragments. And then were several of the warriors sick and purged themselves upon the ground. And the general horror was very great, to my mystification. Now they set off for the great hall of King Hrothgar. No man spoke during our travel, which was better than an hour. The hall was surrounded on all sides by several dwellings in the fashion of the North people, but there were no fortifications or earthworks to be seen. Rather, from the great hall and the long houses about it, the ground sloped to a long, flat, green plain, here and there a farmhouse, and then, beyond, the hills and the edge of the forest. I inquired of Hergr whose long houses were these, and he said to me,
"Some belong to the king, and others are for his royal family, his nobles, and also for the servants and lower members of his court."
He said also that it was a difficult place, though I did not comprehend the meaning in this.